all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Richard Vandenbroel, who is a board member with the World War I Historical Association. Richard, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you very much, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to our conversation. I hope it'll help the veterans.
Well, I'm sure it will. It's nice to have somebody who has this particular interest in hand. Richard comes by it naturally, I guess I'd say, because he has his bachelor's in history from Miami University. He holds a law degree. He's a personal financial expert. And as I said at the outset, this scholar is a board member of the World War I Historical Association. And this is a big year for World War I buffs because it's the 100th anniversary of America's entrance into World War I. Richard, do you want to tell us a little bit about why the heck we got in this war to start with?
Yeah, let's start with the very beginning, because we didn't get in until 1917. The war starts in 1914, and basically you've got five major empires. The Austro-Hungarians, where my relatives came from, they were Ukrainians from Galicia. They came here in 1910, which I'm grateful for, because in 1914 a million Russians showed up on the border and just devastated that part of the empire, and they fought the Austro-Hungarians. But it was Germany and their Austro-Hungarian allies, and then later on the Ottoman Empire, which is something I want to address because our Middle East involvement stems directly from the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. Germany, Austria-Hungary, Ottoman Empire versus Russia, France, and England. And the war begins August 2nd, 1914. It's a little over a month after the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne, Franz Ferdinand, and his wife were assassinated in Sarajevo by a 17-year-old Serbian terrorist teenager. And so that happens June 28th. The war starts August 2nd, and most of these countries thought it'd be over by Christmas. Turns out it wasn't. By then, they dug the trenches, and after several years fighting, they still hadn't made much progress. The reason we got in, by the way, is because the Germans announced they were going to have unrestricted submarine warfare in January 1917, which means they're going to sink everything. They're trying to starve the British. Then, in addition, the Germans sent a telegram, the famous Zimmerman telegram, to the Mexicans, offering to give them Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico if they would invade the United States. Well, that meant President Wilson had little choice but to go to Congress, and on April 6th, the United States declared war on Germany. And but you can declare war but not be prepared, and quite frankly, we were not prepared. We had a relatively small army led by General Pershing, who had recently been in Mexico trying to find Pancho Villa, who had attacked a U.S. city in New Mexico, Columbus. Anyway, we first sent over some Marines because the Marines were ready. They could send over actual people ready to go and contribute to the war effort on the Western Front. But within a year, the United States had actually sent 2 million troops over to France, and 2 million more were being trained. So by the end of the war, we had mobilized almost 5 million men, and we lost 113,000 killed. Fortunately, half of them died of the Spanish flu, having never left the United States. Some of them died over in Europe. 200,000 wounded, and basically the Germans realized when we got into the war, the game was up, because by then the Germans, the French, and the British had exhausted all of their manpower. The Russians had dropped out. The Russian Revolution had started, another major event of 1917. So to bring us all up to date, the Ottoman Empire by 1918, the Allenby, the British general, had gotten to Jerusalem, first time That city had been taken since the Crusaders in 1200. So at the end of the war, we had the peace treaty of Versailles, 1919. We had the armistice, 1918. And then there was a secret treaty that the British and French had signed called Sykes-Picot, where they divided up the Middle East. France got Syria, which at that time included Lebanon. England took over Palestine, which included today's Israel, Jordan, and they also took over Iraq. So they took over Iraq because they wanted the oil. They had converted their ships from coal to oil, and they had a base at Aden in Yemen, so that they wanted to protect the Suez Canal. And so we basically came away disgusted, quite frankly, with the old European ways, secret treaties, and a feeling that let's just come back here and kind of leave those folks alone, if you will.
Well, and indeed, there was a large, you know, isolationist view. America wasn't a world power at that point before this started. And while we skipped over this, I think, because I want to talk about its effect, World War I's effect on today, but 9 million soldiers, sailors, airmen, and another 5 million civilians died in World War
I. It's absolute carnage. There's no question about it. In fact, I've gone on several battlefield tours over to France, and you go to these villages that were destroyed between 1914 and 1918, and there's really nothing but ruins. France lost 1,300,000 men. England lost 1 million. Germany lost a couple million. Russia lost a couple million. Austria-Hungary did. You can imagine the impact on their countries after the war was devastating. They didn't have the manpower for the labor for the farms. Plus, the jobs were all gone. The economies were destroyed. We did emerge as the world's banker, the United States did, and we profited from World War I in that we did supply Britain and France with munitions and food and in addition to our troops. So we did emerge powerful, but not ready to really take on the leading role we did after World War II.
Well, and that's an interesting aspect of this war, where it really was the first use of airplanes and tanks and submarines and chemical warfare, all the stuff we don't want to talk about. But out of that, unfortunately, I guess, because it was so destructive on the European continent, the United States became maybe a reluctant but a superpower, didn't it?
Absolutely. In fact, there was a great learning curve. Our military, the professionals who really run the military, learned a lot. Here's a good example. The British went to Gallipoli hoping they could win against Turkey by their soft underbelly, and it didn't work out. After 1915, this is Churchill's idea, after 11 months they found they weren't going to be able to get Turkey that way. So the British Marines, though, had landed troops on the beaches of Gallipoli, and their takeaway from this was you couldn't really invade a beach. Okay, that's the British Marines. The U.S. Marine Corps decides to study this a little more thoroughly. So all during the 20s and 30s, they developed the ability to land on beaches with landing craft. They developed a whole way to attack a beach, to take a beach, with the right weapons, the right tactics, and so on. So as World War II begins to unfold, lo and behold, we're fighting in the Pacific, where my father spent he was in the Navy, starting with Pearl Harbor. He was in and survived. So anyway, the Marines learned how to take beaches, and that was a learning thing. We also had a lot of World War I military figures who were the leaders in World War II, Eisenhower, Patton, MacArthur. And there's a whole bunch of people that led all of our services, the Navy, the Army, the Marines, and then later on we had the Army Air Corps. So they all learned from World War I, and they helped our success in World War II.
And this is also true for the other participants in World War II. World War I was the training ground where Adolf Hitler served as a...
He was a second corporal. He was a runner. He was basically the guy who ran messages from the trenches back to the where the officers were and delivered messages, because all those explosions blew up all the telephone lines all the time. So other than the carrier pigeons, the only recourse you had was to literally hand someone a written message and say, here, take that to the lieutenant or the captain or something. And that's what he did.
And you have others like Rommel and Goering and Mussolini. I mean, everybody who we know from World War II played a minor role in World War I, it appears.
Well, Goering was an ace in the German Air Force. He took over from the Red Baron there when he was shot down. Mussolini, of course, leads the fascists and takes over Italy in the 20s, which is a model that Hitler follows. And by the way, all the founders of the Nazi Party, for the most part, were World War I veterans. In fact, the corps, the German officer corps, they're all World War I veterans. And they then build the Wehrmacht. And the same thing. Now, the Russian, the sad thing about Russia is the ones who fought in the Red Army and won for the communists and the Bolsheviks, Stalin eliminated most of them during the 30s. About 80% of his experienced officer corps, who had been the ones who were the victors during the Civil War. And so when World War II starts and the Germans invade Russia, he lacks the experienced officer corps to lead the Red Army.
So it's interesting, because on Russia, really, right? That's the that's one of the monarchies that fell during World War I. So that you can have the rise of the Russia we know, but you wouldn't have had that, I suppose, if you didn't lose the monarchy. And you've mentioned the Ottoman Empire, and certainly the monarchy in Germany and Turkey. I mean, it's interesting how World War I really changed the geopolitical landscape, isn't it?
Yeah, let's look at the Middle East, because we're still involved in the Middle East. Okay, so the Ottoman Empire extended into what would now be Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Jordan, Israel, Syria, Lebanon. They even had Libya, but the Italians kicked them out of Libya in 1911, and the British were in Egypt, which had been part of the Ottoman Empire. And then the Ottomans had been fighting in the Balkans, of course, where World War I actually starts in Serbia, but the Serbs had gained their independence from the Ottomans, the Bulgarians, Macedonians, and so on. So at the end of the war, then, the Europeans, British and French primarily, carve up Turkey, and the Greeks are there, too. So the Turkey has a civil war that finally has ended about 1922. And so in many ways, to me, that whole area has never quite recovered from the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, which had been around roughly for over 500 years. And that much seems to be written about the impact of the fall of these empires, but think about it. People lived in somebody's empire in 1914, most people did, that they knew what the rules were, right? I mean, they knew how to get along, where what schools to go to, how to record property, and just do all those kind of things. It's all gone in 1918. And they have to reinvent everything.
Well, and part of that reinvention were these countries with made-up lines, made-up boundaries, maybe even made-up countries, you might say. And that comes right out of these treaties, some of them publicly, I guess, negotiated. But you say there was a secret treaty among the successful participants in the war.
Yeah, and the boundaries, you know, there's a lady who is very famous, Gertrude Bell. I just saw the movie about her. Queen of the Desert. She was actually an English woman who got to know all these tribal leaders very well. She didn't want to get married and do the traditional things. She went to first graduate, I think, at Cambridge. Anyway, she goes to the Middle East. She's very wealthy, and she learns Arabic. She really knows these different tribal leaders, and it is a tribal system, but she's the one who is involved at Versailles along with T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, who's another expert in that part of the world. And they literally draw the boundaries on a tablecloth at dinner with Churchill on what is today Iraq. And we know in Iraq, for example, there's three competing peoples. You've got the Shiites, you've got the Sunnis, and you've got the Kurds. And it's an artificial country to the extent there was never historically in Iraq.
And that division, listeners, we're talking to Richard Vandenbroel, who's a board member with the World War I Historical Association. Richard, that that division then of Iraq, or the drawing of Iraq where these three competing interests are, that comes out of the World War One.
It's World War, the end of World War One at the Versailles Peace Treaty, which divides up essentially the countries that were the losing powers were. Like, for example, Poland's created out of Germany. The Poland was occupied by Germany, Russia, and Austro-Hungarian Empire. Then they create a new country, Poland, and a lot of other countries, the former ones of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, for example. Now you have Czechoslovakia, which has also been broken up since then. But all these countries are formed because of World War One ending. So you have Hungary and Austria and Romania and so on. Ukraine, for example, for a little while, and then they get gobbled up by the Soviet Union and so on. And then France takes over what today would be Syria plus Lebanon. Later on, they carve out Lebanon because they carve out, it's roughly 50% Christian, 50% Muslim, and they figure they can hold their own that way. And historically, the French had viewed themselves as protectors of the Christians. I mean, there's a lot of history here.
Well, that's right. And then we're looking back 100 years and saying, how did getting into this war and the conclusion of World War One impact life today? Let's switch out of the geopolitical for a moment.
Sure.
And talk a little bit about, because we mentioned at the outset, while there's 9 million or soldiers and another 5 million civilian who die, there's also something like 7 million men who become permanently disabled. And you mentioned the flu, influenza epidemic, killed millions of
estimates
people.
Estimates range from 25 to 50 million worldwide. One little story on that. My grandmother came from Belgium, and her father had a farm in Belgium, and he had four sons. They had helped the French bring in the harvest, and they came home and said there's going to be a war. He didn't want his sons to be killed, so he says, well, why don't we just sell the farm, move to the United States, which they did, up around Rochester, New York, where I grew up. And to this day, there's still farms, the Conic, which is Belgium. And my father and his twin brother, who were both at Pearl Harbor serving in the Navy, were born November 28, 1918. And my grandmother's sister says, I'd like to bring my husband over to see the twins. And my grandmother says, no. 6 months later, her sister's husband dies of the flu. He's 27 years old and leaves her a widow. And that wasn't unusual. Let's talk about the disfigured veterans, because there's thousands and thousands and thousands of them. A whole industry has developed to help these people, okay? In fact, the Straith Clinic here in Southfield, was founded by Dr. Straith, actually went over to France to learn plastic surgery, or the beginnings of plastic surgery, from the French, who had thousands of maimed soldiers. They helped them with prosthetics. They actually painted, something they could actually put on their face to disguise the facial wounds. And so these men could at least go out in public with some dignity and not despair, if you will. So he came back here, and he actually was instrumental in pushing for padded dashboards and everything because of all the people that remained in auto accidents. When the veterans came back to the United States, the VA wasn't what it is today. It was more of there was a Veterans Administration, but they hadn't had to deal with the sheer numbers of people coming back here who were suffering from shell shock and gas, maiming, and so on. So what they wanted to do was kind of cover up the effects of the war. So they gave them the prosthetics, and they helped them with their plastic surgery things. And in the mid-20s, they gave the veterans their certificate, which was like a bonus. It was meant to be a bonus for their service. President Coolidge said the only thing you should give them is just they were patriotic. Well, you can't live on patriotic, right? So anyway, Congress passed this bonus. The way it worked was this. You got a certificate payable in 1945. It was worth about $500. In 1932, the veterans, this is the depths of the Depression. There's 25% unemployment. 20,000 veterans go to Washington camping out, literally begging Congress, we need our bonus money now, right? Well, Congress, in its infinite wisdom, turned them down. Apparently, in the aggregate, if you added up the 3.5 million veterans who are still alive, the cost of the bonus would have been over $3.5 billion, and the government didn't have $3.5 billion. So,
well, unfortunately, that tale continues to be told and echo through the ages 100 years later, where we send men and women into war, but we're not, as a country, quite willing to pay all the residual costs associated with that service. But I think you're reminding us that World War I really helped advance not only medicine, but because of the large number of veterans, helped us advance as a country how we think about providing benefits to those who have served.
It absolutely helped the World War II veterans, my father specifically. After suffering through depression, which he did, then serving his country, he joined the Naval Reserves in 1935 at 17, so by 45 he's got 10 years in. He was promised his job back at Kodak. We're from Rochester, New York. So when all he could think about, quite frankly, was getting back to Rochester. He had enough of war, and here's a job that's, his father didn't work during the Depression. So my father did get his job back at Kodak. He worked there during the glory days of film, and he retired in 1982 with a pension, and he worked there 35 years. So it worked out well for him. And that was there were several promises that were made to World War II veterans. The most well-known is probably the GI Bill, which benefited us as a nation immensely because of all the people who went to college and became scientists and,
right.
and educators and so on. And then the mortgages helped the housing industry tremendously. And then finally, the companies that had promised jobs, veterans were given jobs. So they definitely did better than the World War I veterans did. And I think now we have clearly people in the United States understand we have an obligation to our veterans.
We're talking to Richard Vandenbroel. Richard, as a scholar of World War I, if others are interested in this topic and want to see how the ripples of World War I impact life today, tell us about the World War I Historical Association.
Well, we were originally incorporated in Michigan as the Western Front Association U.S. branch, and then there was another group out in the Bay Area of California called the Great War Society. Each group had roughly 350 members, but over the years they've died off, and so we finally realized several years ago we should really merge the two organizations. There was some rivalry, which we don't have time to get into it, but by the time we merged, there wasn't any rivalry. We realized just to survive, we better do this. So I merged them in Michigan. It was very easy. I called up Lansing, said, how do I merge it? They just said, well, fill this form out here and put the name change down. Now it's all there was to it. Very easy to deal with.
The website.
And that's what we did.
Yeah, the website.
And there is a web page.
Yeah, tell us what the website
is. Yeah,
Okay, I've got it in front of me.
HA.org. Yeah,
right.
World War I Historical Association.org. If you go to Facebook and just put in World War I Historical Association, you'll see our web page. And there's another one that is very good called Trenches on the Web, and they have any number of publications that have covered every subject you could imagine, what kind of weapons were used, what kind of training, casualties, battles, tactics. Airfare, there's all kinds of stuff that is on the air wars. One of our members who's on our board worked for the CIA, and his expertise is a whole presentation just on the French bombing campaign.
Well, I want to thank you, Richard Vandenbroel, for participating on this Veterans Radio interview today. I want to encourage our listeners who want to maybe delve a little deeper to go to www.ww1ha.org. For the World War I Historical Association. It's a great website, easy to find information on it, and specific information that I think you might learn a lot on. Richard, thank you for participating today. We appreciate it and all that you're doing to keep this history alive.
Thanks, Jim. It was my pleasure.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.